If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is episode 420 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abuel Salmon from Telemetry, and I'm the only one here right now because Nicole and Robbie are both traveling this weekend. But I have had a bunch of conversations with people over the last couple of weeks at a couple of different conferences I attended. These have all been already available to Patreon supporters. But now everybody can listen in on these. I think there's some really good stuff here. So have a listen. We're going to start off with Mike Dowsett, who is the chief engineer, head of development for electric drive systems at Magna International. Magna is one of the largest automotive suppliers in the world, and they produce just about everything, almost every part that goes into a vehicle for some automaker or another, in many cases, many automakers for similar components. So I talked to Mike at the Center for Automotive Research Management briefing seminar in Detroit last week, have a listen.
All right, Mike, let's talk about electrification.
My favorite subject.
Yeah, I just listened to your panel over here. And I guess let's start off with, you know, the industry is in, shall we say, a state of flux right now. Trying to figure out what to do next. From your perspective, leading the EV and electric propulsion stuff for Magna, what are you seeing right now overall from the industry?
I think that the consumers are making their voice heard. They weren't quite ready for the trajectory that we saw BEVs. I think the whole industry was expecting a much faster growth. Mm-hmm. And I kind of touched on it just now up on stage that certainly in North America, I do think we have some unique challenges, and that is the vastness of the country. There are a lot of Americans that don't live in a city, don't have access to a Maya with 10 superchargers in the parking lot. There are many Americans that don't have a garage there they can put their own charger. So I think an adjustment was the right thing to do. I think that the demand we're seeing now for hybrids is real, and I think it will continue for some time. I do think, again, touched on it on stage briefly, but a plug-in hybrid with a reasonable size battery can deliver for the consumer some really exciting electric performance that they won't have been used to. And they'll feel and see the difference between that and their combustion engine. And if you can get a plug-in hybrid with 50, 60 miles of range, which they're trying to do with CARB, I think that's the way to go. And then we're going to start to educate the masses that actually electric powertrains are great to drive. They're exciting. They're silent. They really do change the driving experience. And I think that will boost the growth. But in the short term, hybrids, absolutely. And again, mentioned it briefly on the stage for Magna. We have a very long heritage of combustion engine powertrains. So world leader in all-wheel drive, four-wheel drive and manual transmissions, DCTs. We've been doing that for decades. And then we worked on electric vehicles and the powertrains for electric vehicles for a decade almost. And now we bring all of that together in a hybrid, which is a very natural place for Magna to be. It brings all of our experience and product knowledge together. And hybrids are real. We're seeing an awful lot of interest on we call it DHD. It's a dedicated hybrid drive where we're actually putting one or two electric motors, high voltage electric motors, into the transmission. That gives real exceptional performance, and it can be a range extender, a parallel, a series hybrid, depending what we do with the clutch and the gear, the clutches and the gears inside that transmission. We can give our OEM customers really any scenario, any driving scenario they like, whether it's combustion engine and electric together, or one or both. We can give any combination of those, and it's more complex. It's not an easy thing for some suppliers to do, but as I mentioned, for Magna, it's a really natural place for us to be. We're using our same engineers, our same global skill set that we have in a real, true global team to deliver these quite exciting hybrid transmissions. So certainly that's going to take up an awful lot of our time for the coming years. I do think we're seeing BEVs alongside it. I think the data that Mike just presented is pretty accurate. But in most of the hybrids for North America, we're going to put an electric drive on the rear axle, for example. So we'll have a hybrid
take us through the road hybrids for those applications.
Yeah,
or
call it a P4. But yeah, just an independent e-drive in the rear. Mm-hmm. Very low cost, but it gives you that all-wheel drive that you need when you get stuck or you can't get up your drive and you just need a little bit more. Or for that overtaking maneuver when you need more torque. So it gives real extreme flexibility. And our portfolio is so broad for electrification, but also hybridization, that we can supply a hybrid transmission up front, either longitudinal or transverse. We have both in our portfolio. A really low-cost e-drive, a P4 in the rear axle, whether they want it. So that's the selection the consumer can make if they want front-wheel drive or if they want all-wheel drive. And all of that exists today in our portfolio. So
it sounds like it's interesting the way you've just described it, is that you kind of come at the hybrid side from... So the opposite direction of somebody like Toyota.
Yes.
That, you know, they've been doing hybrids the late 1990s.
Yes.
And Magna focused more on BEV over the last decade.
Yes.
And now and Toyota, Honda, they're taking what they learned from hybrids to bring it to plug-ins and BEVs.
Yeah, I had
to. And you're going the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And so have you been able to leverage some of the lessons learned from developing BEV or pure electrified powertrains to what you're doing on the hybrid side?
Yeah, it's a great question, and absolutely yes is the easy answer is yes. So the application of high voltage electric motors into a transmission is not an easy task. There have been a lot of lessons learned in our first programs using full EVs. All of that pours into a hybrid transmission. It's extremely compact. There's a lot going on in a hybrid transmission. We're not given any more space in the vehicle than the original ICE transmission. So we have to get two big electric motors, typically, a couple of clutches, usually. And we will get all of that into the existing drive. And to do that, we use all of our lessons learned. So we've been working on hybrid transmissions a lot longer, especially in Europe. We started off with 48 volt and we're now up at 800 volt and 400 volt. And because we're a truly global engineering team, at least, we certainly transfer all those lessons learned for local engineering to support an individual customer. So we've won business on hybrid transmissions in China and North America and in Europe. So we share those lessons learned on a daily basis. We have a system just for lessons learned. And they really go down into the absolute detail of designing one of these transmissions for our customers.
So one of the interesting things, like from the conversation yesterday, I don't know if you were here yesterday, but Cherry Wyckoski, president of Teersop, talked about is one of the things that's different in China, for example, one of the advantages they have versus the Western automakers, is the Western automakers often, you know, they'll go to a supplier. A supplier will have a product off the shelf, but they will want something slightly customized for their use case.
Yep.
Whereas in China, the automakers are much more inclined to just take whatever's off the shelf, and they get the benefit of lower costs because that supplier is selling 2, 3, 4 million of the same part to multiple OEMs. Are you finding now with OEMs, Western OEMs, that they are more willing to take essentially an off-the-shelf component as opposed to something that's more bespoke, especially because of the fact that they are now having to go back and invest down multiple pathways, whereas they were hoping to go all BEV before?
I think there's a really strong desire from the big OEMs to do what you just described, reusing what's there. That typically Especially those with all that combustion engine heritage, they're struggling to do that. They always want their unique spin on something. But there's a strong desire to do that, to drive costs down. At Magna, what we do is we have what's called building blocks. So in every aspect of our powertrain, we have split up into building blocks, all the different aspects. I'll give you one example, an oil pump, for example, that we would have in a transmission or an e-drive. And we have a building block that looks after just the oil cut. They look after another actuator, but it focuses on that globally. So if we've found either an off-the-shelf third-party oil pump that we can use, or if we design and develop on ourselves, that will be owned and managed by a building block. And we in engineering are charged to reuse as much of that as we can. So before we ever sit down, we start with our clean sheet of paper. No, we start with an existing e-drive or transmission, and then we see how much of that we can reuse. And that does include taking off-the-shelf components from other tier 2, 3, 4 suppliers and trying very hard to reuse it as is. Because we know if we change one thing, it has to be tested and validated, and it drives significant incremental costs. So we're trying ever so hard with all of our drives, combustion engine, whether they're hybrid or EV, to reuse these standard components from across our building blocks. And we've been more and more successful at that as we move forward. And we also get into a point where we're now able to collaborate really closely with an OEM, and we can justify some of those standard components. We will say, I understand you would like this oil pump, for example, but however, if you use this oil pump, we can save you X dollars, both in terms of engineering and piece price.
Yeah.
And I'm finding certainly that the OEMs are more and more open to that. Some of them are still struggling with their legacy, but there's a huge drive for affordable vehicles, especially EVs.
Yeah. Especially since so many of these components that do add that incremental cost,
yeah,
are not things that differentiate the product from the consumer perspective. Consumer doesn't care where that oil pump is from, as long as it works.
I agree. Well, yeah, I agree with you. In powertrain, though, adjusting one widget in the overall can affect the performance of the vehicle, whether it's torque or power or longevity or it move it. So for an oil pump, if you find an oil pump that doesn't quite deliver the volume of oil you need, or at that cold viscosity when it's 0 degrees, that can impact the overall performance and then the consumer feel for the power. We all feel the powertrain, whether we know it or not, you know, you feel it through the seat of your pants. So that's all a factor. And many of the OEMs, especially in BEVs, are looking for how do they transmit their brand now. Most OEMs used to deliver their brand through their engine. They owned their engines, they tuned them, they made them.
It's a lot harder to do with electric drive.
Exactly that. So when you start to suggest changes that could impact the drivability, the way it accelerates, the way it decelerates, the noise, all of those factors come into that widget, unfortunately. So, but the good news is there's very much a two-way collaboration with the OEMs now to come up with the best overall solution, still hit their brand that they're looking for, their drivability, the way the vehicle feels, but try and reuse as much as we can. You know, to validate any drivetrain is many, many millions of dollars. You only have to change one aspect, but you have to test the whole thing again for a long time. So the picture's clear, and in engineering, we're absolutely charged for maximum reuse. And if we come up with something new, we're already thinking about the next programs and how adaptable and flexible that is. So I'm designing an e-drive now with my team in Troy, and we're designing it primarily for the North American market and what we're seeing, but we also know it's going to be in demand in China and Europe for slightly different reasons. So we're building into that flexibility. And that's really important because overall, it's going to drive down the cost of our powertrains and make better business for Magna.
Going back to hybrid drives for a minute, what is Magna's approach to the hybrid drive architecture? Are you doing it combining the motors with a step ratio transmission, or doing the ECVT type of architecture, or are you doing both?
Both. Okay. Whatever our customer wants. And we have them all in our portfolio. So there's an interesting demand from our customers and their consumers that's, it's the full breadth of all of the different hybrid transmissions. If you see our commercial depictions of DHD, our dedicated hybrid drives, you see it's one motor, two motor, series operation, parallel, extended reins. They're all in there, and we can do all of those. Usually the biggest constraint is the package space. How much space do we have to work with? And sometimes that can dictate what type of hybrid drive it is. And we've seen all of those, literally the full spectrum. The best is when you can have a dedicated hybrid drive that has a generator in it and a traction motor that can operate in all of those different modes and give absolute flexibility to the OEM. Costs a little more money, doesn't optimize one or the other, but gives you a really good performance, pure electric. It can give you electric and combustion engine if you're hauling your boat out of the lake. Absolute flexibility, as long as the battery's big enough. Yeah. I kind of touched on it on the stage. HEVs with their tiny battery are very limited electrically. But the plug-in hybrids with a decent 20, 30 kilowatt-hour battery can do some incredible things. Yeah. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, kind of no, around it. Did. That sounds like you're using that building block approach. You got the same basic motor designs that you can combine with different gear sets and different combinations depending on all the other constraints that you have in the vehicle.
It's a really good point. We are trying to reuse all of our motors and the inverters that drive them as much as possible, and there is quite a lot of flexibility in doing that. So yes, absolutely, we can reuse motors and the inverter that drives them, and then just adjust within the gearing to give the OEM what they want. That's what we do every day. That's our business.
So, talked about hybrids, plug-in hybrids. EREVs is an area that's getting a lot of attention. You mentioned it up on stage. So this idea of the extended range EV, where the propulsion of the vehicle is exclusively from the electric drive units. Yes. And you've got an engine, an internal combustion engine, driving a generator to extend your range. The first of those for the North American market should be arriving first half of next year from Stellantis. But beyond that, how much interest are you seeing from OEMs or North America for EREV applications? And, are they coming to you, or are they doing it more in-house, or... And what kind of applications?
It's funny. The answer is always yes with Magna. We're so big, and we have such a depth of knowledge. We're seeing a lot of interest, and North America is the primary market, but we are getting interest in China and Europe as well. But North America is the primary one. There are a couple of ways you can do this, and it doesn't have to be a combustion engine driving the range.
It could be a dual cell.
There could be some other things. So, again... I come back to the thing I said earlier about the vastness of the US. I've thought for more than a decade that a range extended battery electric vehicle is the ultimate solution for North America. You may not use that range extender for 3-4 months, but on the day you need it, it's there, and you've got a small tank of gasoline. And that's the reassurance that many North American customers are looking for. The range extender piece is not so expensive. You know, I've been driving VEVs for a few years now. And if there were an option to tick a box for $1,000 for a range extender, I would tick it every time. I don't think I'd ever use it, but I would still tick it.
Can you get the cost down to that point where, it'd be $1,000?
I think we have to. I think it's in that ballpark. It might be $1,500. It might be $800. It depends on how much power does that range extender produce.
Yeah.
Big part of that.
And I can see where, something like, what BMW did with the i3.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could definitely get it down to that price point.
Yes.
But, that vehicle was also extremely limited. Once you're into range extended mode, you only had about 2 gallons of gas, and, it was power limited and speed limited. And
so we've worked on lots of solutions, from a small SUV to the big trucks, and a range extender for the big trucks is like a V6 usually.
Yeah,
it's a big engine. And then we're not really emission free, are we, at that stage, even if you put really good after treatment on that? I think the lowest cost range extender is one that will keep you running at 70 mile an hour. You know, God, I think it needs 4, 5, 6, 7 gallons of gas.
Yeah.
But it depends. Again, it comes back to that OEM brand. What do they want? What are they looking for? And we do see the entire range from our OEM customers. There isn't a one system that's dominating. They are all over the place.
Okay.
It appears that that piece of our technology hasn't found its North Star, its silver lining. They are all over the place, but they're reusing what we know. So the motor's in there, the inverter's in there, the gearbox that drives it for the optimum speed and efficiency, all of that is what we do every day. So it's coming. Don't know that there's a one job that fixes all, but we're seeing more and more interest in that.
So, and if you had to look forward 5 years, at the North American market, in China right now, and you've got EREVs, in all kinds of different vehicles.
Yes.
But where do you think we're most likely to see them in North America? Is it going to be the bigger trucks and utilities, or is it going to be that mix, EREVs in different applications?
I think it's going to be the mix.
Okay.
We have such a diverse consumer base that there are so many different applications. The range anxiety issue has not been fixed. We're still suffering from that. It needs a lot more work. And I do think range extenders are a really good midterm solution. I think their future is limited. Mm-hmm. There will be a transition to pure BEV. But I think the next decade is going to be full of range extenders in different formats.
Yeah.
Whether they're true range extender, very high electrical power, giving you full capability until your gas tank is empty, or whether ones that just keep you at motor freeway speed until you can get to a charging station. I think we'll see all of those. And family SUVs are probably the highest anxiety of any. They want that backup plan should they forget to charge, or as I get occasionally, the app on my phone doesn't quite do what I asked it to do, and you come out in the morning and your battery didn't charge overnight. Yeah. So I think having the backup is a really good short to mid-term solution. And as I say, we're seeing a lot of interest in that. We're doing a lot of work.
Yeah, I think once the charging infrastructure is more built out and consumers are more comfortable with the reliability of it, that they know that when they get to a charger, they're going to be able to charge reasonably quickly,
and
the chargers are going to be working when they get there. And I think, the other thing, of course, is, as people get accustomed, especially with plug-in hybrids, and they realize, my plug-in hybrid's got 40 or 50 miles of electric range, and I haven't put gas in it for 6 months.
Yep.
Do I really need a 400 or 500 mile BEV?
And then I absolutely agree. And then you throw in with that the fabulous driving experience that is a BEV, their next vehicle will not have a combustion engine in it.
Yeah.
Most people are 50, 60 mile range. As they're trying to push in California is enough for most people. I have a round trip of 180 miles in my BEV to go to the office and home. So my BEV gets a really good workout, and I've been on road trips and charged on road trips. Never had a problem. I have zero range anxiety, but...
What are you driving?
Tesla Model Y Performance.
Okay.
And I had a Model Y before that, all-wheel drive, for many years. No complaints. I mean, absolutely wonderful vehicle and zero range anxiety.
Yeah.
And that includes pretty long road trips. The supercharger network and the way it works with the GPS is very confidence-inspiring. So I keep pushing the EV button, but in the meantime, hybrids, they're great for those that aren't quite on board yet. And as I say, I do think the next decade and a little bit more, we're going to be dominated by hybrids. When I talk to non-automotive people, their first response is, I want a hybrid. They don't even really fully understand it, but they've already convinced themselves they want a hybrid.
Well, the cost differential between just a straight-up gas engine and a hybrid has gotten so relatively small.
Yes.
And you get so much benefit out of it, yes, in terms of fuel efficiency, that it makes sense that should really be kind of the default. That's your starting point for pretty much everyone.
Makes a lot of sense. And with battery prices coming down, mm-hmm, that's going to get better and better and better.
So. Yeah. Yeah. In a lot of cases, you know, you're only looking at $2,000, $2,500 premium for a hybrid version of the same vehicle. And instead of 30 miles per gallon, you're getting 50.
Yeah, or if you have a short commute, 100.
Yeah,
no, electric miles per gallon. That's, yeah, I agree.
So one more thing on PHEVs versus EREV. You know, given that, you know, a PHEV is fairly mechanically complex, you know, the hybrid drive unit compared to an EREV is mechanically simpler in a lot of respects. You know, typically has a larger battery, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that large. Which one do you think is going to be the bigger factor in the North American market?
It's very hard to say, but based on the discussions I've had with some of our customers, some of the vehicle maneuvers that define our industry, for example, hauling a boat out of the lake up Davis Dam and continuing that for a couple of miles, you can't do electric only. So you really need the combination of the internal combustion engine and the electric motor to achieve what we've been doing for years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is going to probably push this PHEV direction.
Okay.
There are an awful lot of Americans that tow and haul huge trailers with huge loads once a year or twice a year, but it doesn't matter.
No.
If you're trying to haul that out of the lake and you haven't got enough torque, that's a bad place to be. So when we design a powertrain, we're really driven by these specific vehicle maneuvers that are still in demand from our customer, the OEM. If we eliminate those, I see a different answer. But right now, those are still very much required by our customers. And to meet those without being a crazy electrical system, we use both the internal combustion engine and the electric motor in combination to achieve those difficult maneuvers. And it's not just hauling. You know, some of the roads in the US go uphill for a long way, miles and miles and miles, and that's challenging for an electric drivetrain. You think PHEV? But certainly the revs are a slightly lower cost and less complex solution, like you mentioned.
No.
So is that, I didn't want to say it depends. That's the answer that everyone,
yeah.
But it really does depend on what does our customer want to do with this vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any final thoughts we haven't talked about?
I don't think so. I kind of touched on it in there. Magna are in a wonderful place because we have, we're receiving extensions on combustion engine business where the market's unsure. We're getting a huge amount of hybrid business right now. And we have a very, very strong BEV, full electrification portfolio. So right now, whichever way it goes, we're in a very strong position to give our customers what they want.
Yeah, you have all the bases covered.
We do. And I find that in this, because the market is so volatile right now, the OEMs are leaning on their big suppliers like Magna that they can trust to deliver something really complex. That's happening more and more. In my time in the industry, I've seen OEMs spreading the net wide, looking for the best solution. But although there are a lot of suppliers out there right now, I do find that because of the complexity and the need to be adapt and change direction quickly and cost effectively, they're looking at people like Magna with huge manufacturing experience, localized manufacturing around the world. It feels like all roads lead to Magna right now, and that's what our customers are telling us as well, because of this adaptability, flexibility, the building block scenario I mentioned, all of that puts us in a really strong position. So that's all. I mean,
okay.
I don't mind which way it turns. Personally, I'm a VEV committed person, and I will continue to try and push that outside of work. You know, I sell my battery electric vehicle to anyone that asks the question.
I've been driving many BEVs for many years and, you know, reviewing them. But we actually just bought our first BEV a couple of months ago.
Congratulations. What did you get?
We bought a Kia EV6. My wife out drives it and she's loving it. It's a beautiful car.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Mike.
Big time. I appreciate it. Thank you.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia.
We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. My next conversation is with Caroline Ferlara and Mike Messina from Brembo. Brembo is probably the world's preeminent manufacturer of high-performance automotive braking systems. They're involved in both production programs, increasingly high-performance vehicles from almost every brand have an option for Brembo brake systems. They are also obviously heavily involved in motorsports. They supply all of the teams in Formula One and in many other series as well. So have a listen.
So Brembo, you know, is obviously probably seen as the most high performance braking manufacturer in the world. You know, supply Formula One, supply many other racing programs, but it's been interesting to watch over the last, you know, 30, 40 years, you know, where it used to be, you know, I've been in the industry, you know, since the beginning of the late 1980s when I graduated, and watching, you know, how Brembo has gone from being really a niche manufacturer to being available on so many mainstream vehicles now, and the evolution of the brand, you know, it's hard to find vehicles that don't offer a Brembo braking package on their performance models anymore. Let's start off with, you know, where you see Brembo today overall.
Is this for me?
Yeah, you get
whoever wants to answer.
So in terms of, you know, obviously my forte is motorsports, and that's where I live. I think a big component, one thing that we're always very sort of aware of, is the reputation. When, you know, you talked about being niche, we were niche because we were very specialized, and only people that were also specialized knew our name. And with that came a certain level of credibility, and that credibility has transcended into that mainstream. And one of the biggest priorities that we've had as a group and as a name is to maintain that level of credibility. You know, I think a lot of times when you go mainstream, you tend to sort of dilute your name. And that's something we've been really, really cautious to preserve. And that comes through technical innovation. So being the Brembo of whatever level you're at, so to speak, you know, when you come sort of, you know, down category, so to speak, you know, you have all these prestigious brands, then you have some other brands that are a little bit more, I don't say blue collar, but a little more mainstream. You know, how do you become the Brembo of that brake, you know, and in terms of brake and your performance, how do you still hit a price point and offer a measurable difference? And so that's been probably the biggest priority. And as far as where I see us today, I think we've been able to do that because we are that next level of whatever it is you're driving. If you have a Brembo options, it brakes notably different than the car that doesn't have it. And people can feel that, they can see it. So there's a technical aspect that's been preserved as well as the aesthetic. And
then if I can add to that, so if you look at company today and just look at the financial reports, I mean, obviously, passenger vehicles is the main part of our revenue generation right now. And this is made out of, you know, we talk about the calipers a lot because this is what you see. And this is very distinctive from a brand standpoint. But our discs business is also huge. So there's a lot of cars that maybe you don't know because it doesn't say, but they have Brembo discs on them. And this is, this has been a very important growth for us. And that's the reason why where we are today also in terms of size, right? So it's not only calipers, but also discs. So, and looking back at how we got there, I mean, so I've been with Brembo for 20 years now. In North America, so really saw the growth of the brand on the market. But definitely motorsports, you know, that's where we started. And we talk about the history this year because it's our 50th anniversary in motorsports. We started in 1975 with Ferrari, right, in Formula One. And everything we did in motorsports really helped us, you know, enter the road car sphere and realm, let's say, of technology and developing the aluminum monoblock calipers, lightweight. And that's what also helped us, you know, get into this market here in the U.S. If you look at the Cadillacs, for example, so back, you know, 10, 12 years ago, they didn't have fixed aluminum calipers. And so we were able to get into the more like mid-premium segment with that technology, offering, you know, some lightweight advantages and, conquer a little bit of that market here in the U.S., so more mainstream. And now it's like we talked about the color, right? It's becoming more distinctive design aspects of the vehicle. So I think the company did a good job in trying to go more mainstream with all the different assets that we had between technology, branding, and manufacturing, because we really expanded our footprint here in North America. So we have manufacturing in Homer, Michigan. We have manufacturing in Mexico. So, you know, we talked yesterday, produce local for local. That's been part of our strategy as well. So all of these elements together really enabled us to get to where we are today. So
I think another one that, you know, technology transfer is a term you hear a lot.
Yeah.
And I think people sort of get, desensitized to it, that, you know, is it real or is it really more of a marketing term? And, That's a real aspect in this company. And if you consider, I think, what are we up to? 16,000 employees globally now?
Yep.
And if I'm not mistaken, on average, it's about 10% of those employees are put into R&D. So at any given day, you've got 1,600 people waking up that are either in motorsports or they're in R&D, they're developing, they're thinking of something. And so motorsports has really helped us in that aspect. One of the things that Caroline mentioned was weight. You know, obviously weight is always of a pinnacle importance. But also drag is as another component of that. And those are things that we've learned in various different forms of motorsports, which just so happens that, you know, electric vehicle manufacturers, they care a lot about weight and they care a lot about drag.
Yeah.
And so we've been able to adapt a lot of those technologies as well into our OE applications.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an engineer by training. I spent the first 17 years of my career working in automotive product development, working primarily on brake systems.
Yeah, you know, that's fair.
Working on brakes, ABS, and then stability control. So working on a lot of the electronic control systems. But I learned a lot about the core functionality of friction brakes during that time, especially early on. And when I started in the early 1990s, you know, it was pretty rare to find anything on in mainstream production with fixed calipers. The brake systems back then were bad. And they were really awful.
Even the good ones.
Yeah. It was pretty unusual. And, you know, when we first started working with vehicles that had some sort of fixed calipers and, you know, later, you know, monoblock caliper, like what Brembo produces, it was transformative in the performance, you know, not only just the core braking performance, but the ability to control them. As you mentioned, with that technology transfer, things like friction reduction, with brakes, when you want the friction, you want it there now, and you want to be able to control it. But when you don't want it, you also want to eliminate that drag.
Disappear into the background.
On an EV where you're, very, or any electrified vehicle, even a hybrid, where you want to recover as much of that kinetic energy as you can, you want to make sure. And, looking at motorsports, I know, one of the areas I follow is IndyCars, and on ovals, they do a lot of work on, and trying to make sure you own back those pads, or in any form of motorsports, you sure don't want that drag.
Right. And the other thing about ovals too, is it's ice cold when they go to stop on pit lane. Yeah. So to have a braking system that has no drag and then activates immediately on contact with no temperature in it, because it's been running around at 221 miles an hour for the last 30 minutes. That's also another technical challenge that, so there's materials that you use and those sort of things, is also part of that equation.
And, one of the interesting developments, especially in the last, let's say probably the last 15 years or so in production cars, longer than that on race cars, has been this adoption of carbon ceramic brakes. I think probably the first car I ever drove with carbon ceramic brakes was the C6 ZR1.
Yes.
Okay.
That had carbon ceramic brakes. I've driven many others since then. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that. What impact does that have? And then, maybe get into the announcement you've got as far as expansion of that capability.
So in terms of, there's a couple of different ways to attack that. From a production standpoint, we've put a huge investment in the production process and owning every step of that. If you think about cast iron, you have a raw material, you melt it down, you pour it into a mold, you have a sheeting process, and all those other things. And it's pretty straightforward, and we control that from top to bottom. But when you get into carbon, if you're talking about carbon in a racing standpoint, or like carbon ceramic in an OE standpoint, application, I should say, there's a lot of steps to that process. And so I think the biggest investment I'm 21 years with Frembo now, and we've literally built factories to build those materials, to eliminate the third party so that we can control all of that. And so that's a big part of it. They always say it's difficult to build one ceramic disc. It's really difficult to build 10,000, and to make them all the same. And, so quality control is a huge aspect of it. One of the other things if you've driven them and that there's really nothing that drives quite like a high performance carbon ceramic setup. The repeatability, one of the biggest aspects of braking. Everybody thinks it's the brakes that stop the car. It's really the tire that stops the car, and it's the brakes that stop the tires. And tire technology has improved dramatically. Suspension technology has improved dramatically. Electronics have improved dramatically. And so the beauty of the ceramic brakes is that you're able to capitalize on that lower rotating mass, which is free horsepower, better ride quality, but also unbelievable repeatability, that they just feel the same every single time.
No fear.
And that's what we really try to get to, is where the brakes are really just taken for granted. You expect when you hit the gas pedal, something's going to happen, and it's going to happen the same way every single time. And really, the brakes are there now. We've achieved that in a lot of those applications, and we've been able to do that because of the thermal properties of ceramics. And cost has managed to come down as volume has proliferated. And I think ceramics have been a great thing. It's also sort of created an expectation too, that they're just going to live forever. And so there's an education component that we're catching up with in terms of one of the questions earlier today was, you start with the consumer, you start with the customer and work back. And for us, those customers have always been the OEs. And now, since our name is attached to it, we have to also have a line of sight to those end users too, and educate them on what it is that they're living with there. And it's great, but just like your tires, it requires a certain level of attention. And so there's some things you should know, in order to maintain, keep it optimized and understand about what you have.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask a you know, an average driver, you know, somebody who's not necessarily enthusiast, chances are they probably won't be able to name a brake system manufacturer. But if they can, probably the one name that they know is Brembo.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we usually do some brand awareness survey, and that's what comes out all the time, is that Brembo is the top of mind, like we said, so exactly what you said. So if they know it, if they know a brand, that's Brembo is the first one that they would mention.
And it's not only amongst brakes, like Yesenic brakes, that we also are a supplier, and there aren't many tier one or below suppliers out in the world that people can just...
Yeah, I mean, most people don't know the... Or at least in the context of automotive suppliers, they don't necessarily know the name Bosch, you know, or Fidelion, or Continental, or
don't know they make your ECU.
Yeah, you know, they may know Continental, you know, from the tires.
Tires
are probably the one supplier that people know just because they see that brand up, and you know they go buy them. But brakes, you know, Brembo is the one name people know. So, How many vehicles a year now are typically equipped with Brembo brake systems?
Yes. This one?
Wow.
That's a very good question.
It's a lot, Oak.
Are we in the millions, or are we...
No, but it's like, yeah, how do we determine? Because between, and again, we talk vehicles, between, you know, we, like we said, so we have vehicles that have only calipers, vehicles that have only the discs, and some that have, so... Maybe looking back at the volumes, we could try to make an estimate.
Volumes.
It's a good exercise for us, but we don't know the answer right now.
We could do it by model, or we could do it by units, right? And those are two different. And there's the motorcycle side.
Now we have motorcycles. We have aftermarket too. So Emily, I have the line of aftermarkets.
And now bicycle.
Now we have the mountain bike. It's a great thing.
Great. We've made probably, I don't know, six bikes that the specialized race team has, but
it's interesting. It's a little bit like if you ask before, how much do you make on an F-150 when you sell it? You know, nobody knows.
Yeah.
And we're getting to that point too, where how many cars have a Brembo component on them now in the U.S. or, you know, globally every year? It's a lot.
Certainly in motorsports, you know, F1, I think, everyone's using Brembo brakes right now.
Every team on the grid.
All 10 teams.
Brembo.
Brembo 11 next year.
Yeah. McLaren uses AB Racing.
But they
are the same
part of Brembo Racing. I guess so.
Yeah, one way or another, it's every team on the grid.
Yeah. In other high-end motorsports, you know, most of them are probably using at least some Brembo components, if not full Brembo brake systems. Brembo, your focus, I think, has been on the hardware side, calipers, linings, rotors. Are you doing anything on the software side yet? You're working with the companies on that.
Roughly, you should think we're, 10 years ago now? We started our first brake-by-wire systems in F1 when they introduced KERS.
Okay.
And you know, integrating that regenerative braking in a seamless, transparent application that the driver doesn't necessarily feel was the first step. And, you know, making the car feel like it's braking normally while it's regenerating electricity on the rear through the rear wheels. Especially in something like an F1 car where you feel everything. It can run over a quarter or a dime and it can tell you which one it was. And brakes, there is no compliance in the braking system in an F1 car. So literally everything that happens, all of that feedback goes right back to his foot. He feels it. And so that was from the software development side of it. Making that seamless integrations was a big step. Now we've moved on into other applications where there's a level of adjustability in it. And teams are starting to address that. And so from the software standpoint, in motorsports, brake-by-wire has been a huge development mountain we've been climbing for the past 10 years. And now you're seeing it on the OE side, where some of that technology is starting to make its way over into, you know, obviously a brake-by-wire in the OE. But we recently announced, was it last year, the year before, Sensify, which is something that we're doing on the OEM side of things, which is sort of, I don't know, what would we say that is? Smart braking?
Intelligent
braking, you know? So it's sort of the evolution. It's the next level of ABS, where now you have the individual corners speaking to a main computer and all acting independently of each other instead of just having one channel that's, you know, delivering signals from an axle, so to speak. You have independent four channel now and happening in real time. And so the software side of things is probably, I think it's, I would say it's our biggest, but it's definitely one of the biggest focuses internally that we have in the past 2 years.
Yeah, I spoke with David Salters from HRC US a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
And we talked about what they're doing in software and how they're utilizing software on the Acura Air X06 and on the IndyCar hybrid system, especially on the Acura, you know, utilizing the software control of the hybrid to do things like preloading the differential and, you know, giving the drivers more control, you know, to tune on the fly. You know, so each driver, you know, especially in an endurance race where you've got multiple drivers, each one can make adjustments to their driving style.
Sure.
So
it affects the braking as well.
Yeah. And yeah, the last thing I worked on as an engineer, you know, before I left engineering in 2007 was for the last couple of years was working on software for, brake by wire systems for hybrids. And, so I'm very familiar with how hard that problem of blending regen and friction braking can be. And that was, you know, that was on mainstream road cars. So I can just imagine what it would be like trying to do that blending on something like an F1 system.
Oh, where you have, you know, you have the most specific, most accurate engineers, the most highly technical guys looking at all of the data. And then you have a Lewis Hamilton who's feeling it.
Yeah.
And so there's a technical aspect that the technical guys are looking at. Well, we like this curve in the data. We like what this is happening here. And then there's a subjective element where the driver says, I don't like it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like how that's dealing.
Well, and going back to what you said earlier about that repeatability, the predictability, that was one of the earliest things I learned in my career from my boss at the time was that, you know, it's got to be absolutely predictable for a driver, even for a consumer on the road, you know, especially for something like brakes. You want to know that when you hit the brakes, certain amount of pressure, you're going to get a certain amount of decel. It's going to feel a certain way every single time.
Right.
And, you know, having that, you know, these kinds of brake systems where it's much more consistent in its behavior, you don't have flexing of the calipers, you know, it doesn't change as much with temperature. And now, you know, the blending of friction and regen.
It's incredible. The other thing that happens too that you see in racing, which you don't see as much on the OE side of it, is one of the things we have to account for in racing is tire degradation. Mm-hmm. You know, so now it's how does it feel when the tires are new and the car is full of fuel, versus how does it feel an hour later when it's out of gas on old tires?
Yeah,
and so it's weight distribution, it's balance, it's contact, it's ability to grip the road has all changed from start to finish. And how do you have a brake system that feels the same and, you know, that follows that curve, you know, over the course of an hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Is a really difficult equation.
What about, I know, you know, for example, in endurance racing, you know, something like 24 Hours of Le Mans, you know, they change the brakes during the course of a race.
Sure.
You know, and so how do you deal depends with
on,
that?
Depends on the model.
In some. And some of the, yeah. So when I started... my first Le Mans was in 2005, and the top cars were all carbon. And we had different carbon materials. We had one material for endurance, one material for sprint race. And to be able to finish that race without a change in carbon was a feat, even 20 years ago. Now, I think we could run 41 hours at Le Mans. It's not even... It's a boring conversation to have that.
Yeah.
From when it comes to carbon.
For the GT cars that are running with steel.
Iron, we're still there. Now, technically, we have friction compounds that will last, and we've done it. We've done all 24 hours without a change. You know, and the question is, you know, just because you can doesn't mean you should, because there's probably going to be a clash at some point, you know. So we used to have, in iron brakes, we used to have a change window at Le Mans, for example, of anywhere from 13 to 16 hours. That was your window. You know, so somewhere in that first 13 to 16 hours, you're going to do a change. You know, you need to make it first pass halfway. Now I think our change windows are 16 to 20.
Okay.
And so you have a big window
So if you've got a race like where you have several hours of rain overnight, they may not need to.
May not need it.
And so it really becomes sort of a strategy thing now. If the guy that I'm racing that you know, we're neck and neck and he comes in for a change, well, at the end of the race, I don't want my old brakes against his new brakes. So I'm going to do a change. We have a safety car.
Yeah.
It takes anywhere from 57 to 68 seconds to change an axle set of brakes now. It's just cheap insurance. Why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah.
And so I think now, you know, it used to be more of a necessity. It's becoming, we're getting to the point now where it's almost more of a tactical decision, or all, you know, we're moving towards luxury, where it's going to be a luxury whether or not you have to do it.
So just to wrap up, kind of, what's the future for Brembo? What's next beyond what you're doing today?
Do you want to talk like motorsports specifically, what you think it is? And then we can.
The funny thing about that question is that I can't talk a lot about the future motorsports programs. we have a lot of, yeah. It's going to be a good year. I mean, you know, 50 years was great, but the 1 year is going to be better.
Yeah.
Well,
I guess from a technological standpoint, what, you know, where do you see things going?
I think certainly friction materials, and whether that's on the disc side or whether that's on the pad side, you know, we've got a lot of optimization software when it comes to caliper design. So we know where the loads are going. You know, a caliper being clamp, obviously, you know, statically is one thing, but dynamically, when the disc is spinning at 170, the loads that go into that thing are a lot different than what most people think. So the things that are improving are the optimization software. Certainly AI is going to play a role in that, in terms of, you know, where the load is going and how do you make that caliper. Where do you put the material in that caliper so that you've got the perfect balance between stiffness and weight, instead of just having to compromise all the time? So that's one aspect of it. Friction materials, you know, you've got global regulations that are determining what kind of base metals or compounds that you can use now. And so looking for things that are, you know, environmentally sustainable and yet perform at the level that they need to. That's going to continue to be a big focus. And, you know, we have a team in a basement right now that's working on some things that would shock you. It shocks me. And so that's that, I think, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, you know, and whether we see that in racing, you know, one of the things you have to think about in racing all the time is the sanctioning body and the rules. You know, they're always focused on parity and bringing all the manufacturers in, but then controlling costs at the same time, while also putting on a great show that everybody wants to come and see.
Yeah.
And that's a really tricky balance. And so you're always in racing, you're always sort of working within those confines. And so in a certain way,
but that's what makes engineers creative, is giving them constraints.
Exactly. And you know, and there's another component, we were talking about this last night, is, you know, with all of those rules, are we stifling that creativity? If everybody has to work in the same kind of box now, where it's no longer, you know, 30 years, 40 years ago in F1, if you could build it, you could run it, you could race it. And that's starting to change just a little bit. But I think certainly materials and maintaining sustainability.
I don't know. I was watching a video on YouTube a few months ago. I can't remember who it was, Sam Collins or something. No, somebody, another guy who does racing videos, and he visited Brembo.
Oh, yeah.
Seeing all the different caliper designs. I mean, all these, yeah, that's it. All these different, you know, they're all Brembo calipers for F1 cars, but they all look so very different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So even though you got a lot of rules,
right.
You know, like I said, you know,
even
constraints force engineers to be creative.
Yeah.
And different ways.
Yeah. Sure. And we, you know, we see, I this is something I learned really quickly when we got into NASCAR was, how hard can it be? All they do is turn left.
Yeah.
That's why it's so hard. It's because all they do is turn left. They have honed that thing into a really specific piece of, and so it's yeah, but again, I think the biggest leaps are going to be in just the material basis. That's what I think is going to be really interesting. And software. And as you have AI kind of playing a role in that too, it's going to get interesting. I wish I could talk more about it.
Yeah.
But we can't say yet.
Yeah. And then on the production side, I mean, Sensify for us is, you know, so the more mainstream applications of the technology will be obviously our main goals for the next years to come. that and like offering the our customers, OEMs, like greener solutions, right? So we had the Greentail. I don't know if you had received or saw that. The Greentail discs that we introduced beginning of the year, right? So help, you know, the OEMs meeting the emissions regulations, started obviously from Europe, European side. But so I would say between those two, that would be a focus for the next years to come.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also spoke with Michael Dunn. I've been meaning to have Michael on the show for ages. Michael is a real expert on the Chinese auto industry in particular. He lived in China for a better part of 25, 26 years, and as well as spending some time in Thailand and Malaysia. And we talked a lot about what's going on with the Chinese auto industry.
All right.
Yeah.
Michael Dunn, CEO of Dunn Insights, and one of the foremost American experts on the Chinese auto industry. You lived in China for a long time, right?
Yes, I was there from 1990 through 2016. So how many years is that?
26 years.
26 years with sidebars in Thailand and Indonesia, but basically Asia for 26 years.
So, and you still, even now, you know, almost a decade later, you still spend a lot of time in China. You talk to a lot of the Chinese companies. For those that are not familiar with the Chinese auto industry, kind of give us an overview of what's going on there. And how has it changed in the last, well, in the last 20 years, but especially in the last five?
For most of this century, global automakers, your Mercedes and Buick, Honda, Toyota, Hyundai, just had golden years in China. Growth and profits. Chinese consumers loved foreign brands, and it looked like forever profit machines for global automakers in China until it didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why Buick still exists today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No China circa 2008, no Buick. So what happened? 2015, Xi Jinping gathers with his lieutenants in Beidaihe, this resort area on the coast, and they put together a blueprint, a master plan that they called Made in China 2025. And the goal was, hey, we're tired of playing catch up with the West in autos and in everything. And they've been not able to catch the West, in particular on internal combustion engines. Second thing was they're importing enormous amounts of oil. They said, how do we change this game? Let's lead in next generation technologies, not follow, and let's get off this oil addiction before it happens. So the solution, batteries and electric cars. And they began to heavily subsidize the manufacture and purchase of EVs inside China. And that kind of grew gradually through the 2010s because Chinese consumers were still not certain batteries, safety, range, charging, don't know, question marks. Enter Tesla. Q1 2020 starts manufacturing the Model 3 in Shanghai. And it's a transformative moment. Chinese consumers suddenly go, wow, EVs are actually cool. We want them. And who else in this country makes EVs? Oh, there's a bunch of other Chinese companies. And we saw EVs just take off from 1 million units a year, about 5% of the market, to this year, 13 million or 50% of the market. So it's this like earthquake where EVs were not cool, Chinese brands were not cool, and suddenly they were everything to the Chinese consumer. And guess what? The global automakers have really taken it on the chin. That's what's happening inside China. You've got a massive dislocation. You've got global automakers sitting on all kinds of extra capacity, Chinese automakers flooding the zone with EVs, price wars, brutal competition. And then one more point, and then we'll go on because I'd like to keep it in tight. What's happened is the price wars are so intense inside China, they've said we need a release valve. What's that release valve? Exports. And so we've seen Chinese exports take off from 1 million in 2020 to this year, close to 7 million cars, number one exporter in the world. That's the picture, the earthquake that happened inside China. And then the, call it the tsunami waves that are hitting the rest of the world now.
So you know, you mentioned, you know, Tesla starting production in Shanghai in 2020. It was kind of the pivot point. Up to that point, Chinese EVs were mostly, you know, on the low end of the market, cheap. They were cheap, but, you know, they weren't anything to get excited about. And in the last 5 years, we've seen this real transformation of the industry. It's like they, I assume you've probably read the book Apple in China.
Yes.
And my understanding is that there's a lot of similar, a lot of parallels between that and what's happened in the auto industry where, you know, the foreign companies come in, they teach the locals, they train the locals, mm-hmm. and then those people go on to start up, work at other companies or start up new companies. Is that the same thing that's happening in the auto industry?
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that because not only did Tesla ignite consumers' imagination around electric vehicles, but Tesla also brought world-class supply chains to China. And guess what? Overnight, all of a sudden, these other EV startups start popping up like NIO and XPeng, Xiaomi, most recently Huawei, coming from the tech industry, just like Tesla, entering the auto industry and saying, wow, we have our supply chains right here in our backyard. This is beautiful. And they've been developed by Tesla. We'll just copy paste onto our cars. It's not as simple as that. The Chinese do their own work. But by and large, the story is...
They're following a similar pattern.
Similar pattern.
Yeah.
And there's always a use-by date for any foreign company operating in China. You're useful to the Chinese for a period of time, and you're treated well.
If you're a foreign company.
A foreign company. Yeah. And then one day, you're not asked to leave, but you're shown the door. That's the exit if you'd like to use it, because life is not going to be that wonderful for you going forward.
So, let's continue the way Chinese automakers are operating. Mm-hmm. You were on a panel this morning, Terry Wykoski, mm-hmm. As president of CareSoft, and then Kerry was mentioning that one of the differences, you know, here or in the West, you know, in North America and Europe, automakers will go to a supplier. He used the example of wiper motors. Everybody's got a proprietary wiper motor. You know, there's similarities, but, you know, everybody wants something slightly different. And so you got all these different variations of basically the same product mm-hmm. that from a consumer perspective, they don't care. Mm-hmm. But in China, it's very different. It's like 20 automakers will go to a supplier and they'll all buy the exact same part. They don't want anything customized. Mm-hmm. Why is that? What have they figured out that we can't seem to figure out?
They see that cars of the future will be differentiated based on their software. Mm-hmm. Everything else, mechanical, is standard, a commodity. Yes, this wiper motor might be slightly better, though. Who cares? What really matters is the experience of the driver or rider inside the cockpit. That would be 80% of their effort to make it seamless, intuitive, fun, and that's what sells in China. So in that regard, they look around, they go, let's be less dumb. How do we source things as low cost as possible for those standard parts? The other thing worth mentioning, and it is important, is that margins in China are very, very thin. Few companies make money, many lose money. That's okay, because their priority is to get scale, take market share. So this is a problem for us in the West. Oh, how do we compete with a company that doesn't care that much about profitability? They're all about, how do I manufacture more and take share? Mm-hmm. That's a problem that hasn't been solved yet for automakers in the West. Like, ooh, without profits, what are we going to do?
Without the profits, I mean, I saw a study earlier this year, I think, that estimated that currently there's about 55% capacity utilization in China. Mm-hmm. And most of the brands have capacity utilization in like the single digits or in the 10 to 20% range, which, you know, I mean, there's no way how do you stay in business like that?
Only in China. We call it the China playbook.
Yeah.
They will say, we being the central government, we want to utterly dominate a given industry. Solar panels are the most famous example of that, but there are others. Steel, shipbuilding, buttons. When I first came to China, everybody's going to do buttons and run everybody out in the world out of the button business. So now it's cars, and they'll say, we want overcapacity. we accept overcapacity, we'll accept price wars at home, we'll accept hyper competition, because that means the fittest of our companies will be able to definitely beat other automakers around the world. And this is what scares the daylights out of people in Europe, Japan, Korea, and the United States right now. How do we contend with a country that has the scale, the supply chains, the speed, the software, the subsidies, and the ambition to basically wipe everyone else out? How do we go up against that?
And is there any chance that we're reaching a point where the various levels of government in China are going to start letting some of the weaker players fall by the wayside? Is that going to happen anytime soon?
That should happen. I'm going to offer a big capital BUT. But when I first got to China in 1990, the government said our goal is to consolidate. We, by the end of the decade, will only have 3, 4, 5, maybe 5 automakers. Mm-hmm. In the ensuing 35 years, the number of automakers is several hundred.
Yeah.
So part of that is the way China's economy, it's not a market economy. The government and industry are working together, and each province wants to have its own auto industry. And how come this Guangdong has it and we're on Anhui can't have it? No, we want our. So there's a built-in inefficiency to the economy. So China isn't necessarily the most efficient economy, but it's very effective when the net result is, oh, we're manufacturing 33 million cars a year. We're exporting 6 million of them, and we seem to be eliminating the competitors. It's a formula that they're somehow comfortable with. Yes, some players will go away, but then some of the ones pop up.
Yeah.
And ones that we thought were dead come back to light. It's like nothing else that we've seen in the world.
And of course, it's not just the Western OEMs that are endangered here, but also suppliers.
Yes.
You know, last year I was at Mobilize Investor Day, and Amnon Shashua basically said, yeah, we're essentially decoupling from the Chinese market. And I've heard the same thing from other suppliers. They're basically giving up on China, you know, where they had a pretty strong presence.
Yes.
And now, you know, there's a shift towards local suppliers.
Definitely a shift. Xi Jinping has this line that every Chinese knows. He references it often. He said, our goal in China is to make China less dependent on the rest of the world and the rest of the world more dependent on China. So what does that mean? In the extreme, China manufactures every single car in the world.
Yeah.
Okay. How does that play out? What about jobs in the West? What about our own industries and technology and national security? So there's a collision. We're on a collision course. Something's going to give.
So, you know, right now, the U.S. And Canada are basically kind of isolated when it comes to Chinese cars. You know, they've been exporting, you know, especially to Latin America, but also increasingly in Europe, Southeast Asia. We're one of the only places where you can't buy a Chinese car. How much longer do you think that lasts?
I could see it breaking. I feel it's like a dam. The dam is about to give, about to break somewhere. And I could see that happening as soon as next quarter. I could see the Trump administration waking up, right or wrong, and saying, look, BYD's offered to make a $7 billion investment and employ 25,000 Americans and build batteries here. Don't we need batteries here in America? Okay, we don't know about it. Let's bring them in. It'd be a great deal. Or he may not. We don't know.
Yeah, because, I mean, at the same time, they're, you know, openly antagonistic to the whole idea of electric vehicles, anything that doesn't burn fossil fuels. So,
yes.
You know, what we just saw last week in Georgia, where ICE went in and rounded up Korean workers that were installing equipment in a plant that's ultimately going to employ thousands of Americans. You know, they rounded them up and threw them out of the country.
That makes no sense.
Yeah.
It's like the world turned upside down.
So, you know, given that, do you see that potentially being something that companies from other countries look at that and say, yeah, you know what? It's not worth investing in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Does it potentially play out that way? Or do they look past that and look long-term and say, you know, at some point we'll move past that?
feeling when I talk to manufacturers outside the United States is it used to be so easy to step into the U.S. and sell into the U.S., whether you're exporting or manufacturing gear. It's gotten harder, but it's still the most profitable place in the world to sell and service cars. So the Chinese in particular are starving for profits. They can't find them at home. They go to places like Southeast Asia, South America, Middle East, Africa. Thin margins there.
You know what?
U.S. is still the place to make money. They kill to get in here. They'll tolerate a lot of inconvenience in exchange for access to this market. So that's our leverage.
Yeah, again, I think it might have been you or Terry that said something like 60% of all the profit in the auto industry
is here in here, America. So they look at that and they go, oh, we got to get in there.
Yeah.
So that's if we're really smart as Americans or in North America, Canada, we use that, maximize that leverage and say, access to our market, the Chinese would do the same. They have done the same. Mm-hmm. Access to this market will cost you a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort. We want your money. We want your IP. We want training. We want promises of more money in exchange for getting that access. We shouldn't give it away.
Yeah. Yeah. So where do you think the first Chinese auto plant appears in the Americas?
Uh-huh. Can it be
Mexico, Canada, or the U.S.?
No one knows. But I would guess southern United States, I'm going to say Georgia, Texas, or Louisiana. Those would be my top three guesses.
Okay.
Yeah. Somewhere in the south, far from unions.
Even with the antagonism towards China, you think they'll still? I mean, like, look, for example, you know, when Ford wanted to build their LFP plant, just initially in Virginia.
Yeah.
And Glenn Youngkin said, nope, we don't want anything related to a Chinese company here. You think that they'll look, the governors in those states will look past that?
It feels like it's going to land with the Trump administration. So I don't know that governors would on their own make that decision. They'd want to look for some interference from Washington. Like, is this okay? Yeah. This okay?
Yeah.
All right, let's go. They go together.
Yeah. Okay. So for the U.S. auto industry, is there any chance at all for them to survive?
It would take a... absolutely. There's absolutely a chance. We've got great resource in terms of talent, experience, engineering. You've got some of the best of the week in terms of capabilities. Where we fall down right now is we're not cost competitive. So how do we get cost competitive? I think we have to align with Japan, Korea, India, and Europe and say, as a group, we are going to jointly, it's almost like a Manhattan Project. We have to find a way to be competitive against the Chinese. How do we do that? Maybe we have design engineering here, manufacturing in India, something else happening in Europe, but it has to be an allied effort. I think alone, it'll be tough.
It, you know, look at Ford, you know, they recently announced their next generation EV platform, large scale casting, structural battery, you know, the same pattern that Tesla started with the Austin built Model Ys. A lot of the Chinese have adopted that architecture. Can a Ford, you know, do it on their own doing that? Or, you know, do they have to partner with a bunch of other companies to potentially make that happen?
It feels like at this juncture, we need everybody in, working together, because the competition out of China is formidable. It's not just low cost, it's high tech, it's high quality, it's advanced manufacturing. It's real. It's like 10 Japans coming at us at the same time.
Of course, you know, at the same time you say that, you know, we've got a lot of policies that are openly antagonizing all of our traditional allies and trading partners. Are they going to want to work with us to make that a reality?
I think it's sort of a situation where it's the least worst option. It's like it's better than that other option, which is standing on their own and trying to contend with China. So they'll be willing to swap to eat bitter, as the Chinese like to say, in order to survive. How do we survive? How do we survive into the next generation and thrive? Probably we have to find a way to cooperate. We should. Mm-hmm. And the United States, I would like to see better behavior out of the United States in terms of how we treat our allies. It's there for us to, it's designed to work for us.
Yeah.
So I'm not I'm confused, actually, about what's going on, and I'm hopeful that it'll all work out in the coming months, but who knows?
Can we do it before the Chinese arrived here, if you think?
Have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, one last thing. You mentioned earlier, and working on a book.
Uh-huh.
Can you just give us a hint of what's coming?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. I'm so thrilled, actually, and terrified to be writing a book. It's called Car Wars, and it's the battle for supremacy in next generation cars between the United States and China. It features a lot of the key characters, the guys you imagine, Elon Musk, the chairman of BYD, Wang Chuanfu, Li Shufu from Geely, Donald Trump, and other players along the way who have shaped things and will shape things going forward. It'll be out next year in 2026, and it's designed to be kind of like a thriller, but because the stakes are sky high, the uncertainty today is also very high, and there will be winners and losers, no doubt.
Well, we'll definitely have to have a long conversation about that when it comes out. I can't wait to read that.
Thank you.
There's so much. I've been in the auto industry for 40 years now, since I started as a co-op at GMI, and this is by far the most interesting period of my career. Terrifying, but interesting.
Terrifying. It's fast. Everything's up in the air. Mm-hmm. There's maximum uncertainty.
Yeah.
And so they say you can't function a business when there's not without certainty. Well, here we are. We're finding a way to somehow cope in an environment where tariffs, geopolitics, batteries, battery supply chains, what about access to magnets? Mm-hmm. Everything is sort of up in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for your time, Michael.
Thank you.
Always good to talk to you.
Enjoyed it.
And finally, I've got a conversation I had at the Move America conference in Detroit this week with Benjamin Millard, who is the general manager for North America at Freedom Move. Freedom Move is a business unit of Stellantis. Over the years, they have gotten into a lot of different business areas, including car sharing and aggregating different mobility services through a single app so that riders could figure out the best trip or the best mode for each trip they took, looking at different ride hailing and transit services all in a single interface. Their most recent endeavor is called Car on Demand, which is a subscription service, really more it's a micro lease service, which is similar in concept to what Hyundai is doing with their Evolve Plus, but it's in addition to Stellantis products, it can also work with any brand of vehicles, with dealers opting in to participate. So have a listen to my conversation with Benjamin.
We are a tech mobility company,
uh-huh.
Always flexible, always digital. That's what we do. And that's what we do our best to provide to the dealers. So historically with dealers, what we do is we deal with loaners as well as trying, to help them getting some external revenue out of the loaner fleet. But what we do as well is we try to bring them new customers for buying cars from them under the form of mobility solutions. So we have a subscription program within Free to Move, which is a micro lease solution. So that's you just pay monthly, that's fully flexible. And what we do for the dealer is we reference the program at the dealership level. And then the customer following exactly the same customer journey as you buying a car from a dealer. If at the end you don't want to sign for that lease for the next 3 years or signing for that loan for the next, I have to stop saying 5 years because now it's not 5 years, it's 6 to 7 years.
Yeah, a loan, yeah. Or more. So eight in some cases, they're crazy, is it?
So what you can do is go for the micro lease option with Freedom Move. And basically what we're going to do is in the back end, we're going to buy the car from the dealer. So
Freedom Move buys the car from the dealer, and then you leave
car to the customer.
Exactly. Is that on a month-to-month basis?
Yep, so that's on a month-to-month basis, fully flexible. Works perfectly well, for EVs. I mean, look, getting the same test drive experience for an EV that when you get for an IC is just doesn't work. of course you're going to fall in love with the car, because when you get an acceleration and everything is just crazy. But then back home, your partner is going to start asking, hey, what did you do? How did I get that pink charge and everything?
Yeah.
So you really need to see.
Yeah, it gives you an opportunity to exactly see what it's like to live with and what the charging
and
shoulder
style and everything. Yeah. Exactly. So that's very good for EVs. That's good.
And when I'm going to come to realize, wait, I only have to charge this thing once a week. Yeah, I only drive 40 miles a day.
Exactly. And most of our customers are keeping the cars for close to 12 months. We are in the 10, 11 months now. So what we do after, of course, is that we find another subscription customer or we sell that car. Can be retailed, I mean, through the dealer, or we can auction that car. But, I mean, that's on the back end. But on the customer experience, what we really try to provide is, as everybody, we started at the beginning by saying, okay, it's all about charging the customer for premium, for getting access to flexibility and doing everything online with a limited offer. It just doesn't work. The thing is, you start saying to the customer, hey, Mr. Customer, you know, subscription is freedom. But then you say, okay, you cannot get access to the entire lineup of that OEM. It's going to be that specific car for that period of time, that color at that dealership. And then the customer starts asking, I mean, it's not freedom, my friend.
How's that different from a regular
lift? So we try to really bring that technology to the dealership without having overlap with what the dealership can close as deals, right? Mm-hmm. The normal, I would say, retail customers, you know. Otherwise, you know, it just means it's not additional incremental sales. It's just, I'm taking the sales that you were doing before. It's not what we want. So we really place that product at the end of that customer journey, unfortunately not successful all the time, helping the dealer saving, you know, on acquisition costs or, you know, rationalizing those costs and making sales that, you know, we're not supposed to have.
Say, for example, somebody comes in, leases a Wagoneer S, or, you know, does this micro lease of a Wagoneer S or a 500E, and they decide after 2 months, yeah, you know, I like this. I want to buy this.
Absolutely.
And then you can make the arrangements with the dealer to have purchased that same car they've been living with for hour long.
And what we do is, so with the Freedom Move Forward by DIA partnership we do, it's a lease to home. So basically on every single monthly payment you do, there is a portion that helps building what could be used as
you're building. We're building equity.
Yep.
Kind of something
equity. Exactly. You're the liquor. Yeah. That's what we, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you mentioned subscription earlier. Is that the subscription program?
That's the subscription program.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, is that applied to any vehicle in the Stellantis lineup, or is it only for the EV?
Even outside Stellantis, we do Nissans, we do Ineos, we do whatever brands. Of course, the brands we love the most are the Stellantis brands.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, talking with the dealers, the thing is now, most of them are holding multiple franchises, right? So they say, okay, look, I really love it, but will this apply to that other brand? Of course we can. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't change anything on the technology standpoint. So you just, I mean, we get connected with the dealer through the DMS, so we have an API in place. We just gather all the inventory, we price in the back end, and then we just send back that price or to the dealer or directly to the customer, and then the customer applies online.
So just trying to understand the logistics of how it works. So you get all that information from the DMS. You have on your website, you have a list of the inventory that's available out there, and then customer goes to Freedom Move. Is it just, go to the Freedom Move website?
Yeah, yep.
And then they look at the inventory list. They say, oh, I want that car. And then you make the acquisition from the dealer. And
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, that's what we do. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not, you're not buying a bunch of vehicles and have those in your inventory.
No, we're just helping you, you know, moving inventory. So, I mean, you can make your own selection as a dealer saying that one, yes, that other, not. That's absolutely possible. But that's what we do. Yeah. So we just gathered the entire inventory. Why? Because the idea behind is to say, why should I offer different? I mean, what I love when I go to a dealership is being able, you know, to choose among that just huge inventory, you know, picking, you know, the color that I want, that trim level, that really specific car. Then when I'm sitting down, you know, looking at the numbers, usually this is when, you know, disappointment can start to happen at some point.
So, the monthly payment for that,
How does that, how would that compare to doing a, going, just going to the dealer and doing a standard lease?
Yeah.
For that same vehicle.
So we try to be that close. What we discovered, I mean, we started doing subscription a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And once again, at the beginning, we said, that's not a problem. Customer will be fine paying a premium for all the operations, all the stuff,
yeah,
just for getting access to flexibility. That's not true. And
the logistics of making that work. I mean, a bunch of companies have tried it and, you know,
and there is a real cost, especially if you try to get disconnected from the dealership. What I mean by that is, if you say, look, Mr. Dealer, send me the car and I'm going to take care about everything. You need logistics. You need, you need points, you know, where you're going to concentrate those cars, people for making delivery and everything. Things that dealers are doing well, I mean, that's no problem. So why not really helping the dealer selling more, right? While at the same time relying on the dealer's logistics and everything. That's what we do. And that makes a big difference. So, I mean, at the end, we don't apply a premium. Of course, there is a calculation, there is a margin on that and everything. But we aim to be really close to a traditional lease by 10, 15% more.
Okay.
But the huge benefit is that there is no down. Once again, there is no commitment that's fully flexible. And that's...
So how popular has this program been so far? Roughly how many customers have chosen this option?
Yeah. So now we have a couple of hundreds. So we get close to 1,000. To give you a sense of scale, so we started with a dealer, Shepman Nissan in New Jersey, Nissan. Over 2 months, we achieved doing together a little bit more than 50 units.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, one dealership, Nissan, 50 units, 2 months, new program.
Yeah,
that's not bad. I mean, yeah. We just put it at the scale of the country, the dealers and everything. So we get close to 1,000. We have dealers in San Diego, Dallas, New Jersey, Miami. We do Jacksonville. We have a couple of leaders. Yeah.
Where would people find it? Is this on the freedommove.com website?
Yeah, you go on the freedommove.com website. Okay. We have a dedicated app for that thing, which is Free to Move Micro Lease app.
Okay.
So in that app, you can, you know, look at the entire inventory, just make your selection, mm-hmm, applying online. You get true approved. You just go to the dealership and then you get your car.
Yep. Over the years, Free to Move is dabbled in a lot of different things, car sharing and, you know, very, oh yeah, I mean that's part of why the system was set up, you know, within Stellantis and originally within PSA.
You're right.
To experiment with different business models, everybody's trying to figure out, okay, you know, what else can we do beyond the traditional dealer, right, consumer model. And, you know, so it's, yeah, it's been interesting to watch, you know, what works, what doesn't. And of course, you know, Stellantis is not the only ones to do it. I mean, others have tried it. does it seem so far like this is something that might stick?
I think that offering, you know, cars that way is definitely something that's going to stick. And I think that OEMs looking on that side for addressing I don't want to call it new needs, but new consumption patterns and everything.
Yeah.
I think that this is definitely something that's going to make sense. But you're absolutely right. Back in 2016, when Freedom Move had been created, we started with Connect to Fleets. So fleet management solution was the primary business of Freedom Move. Then starting doing car sharing.
And then at one point you had an aggregator app that, correct, tied into multiple ride-hailing servicers. Well, I think that was only in Europe, but I think that was where I first heard of Freedom Move, was when the
app was not done by a Freedom Move company. Was done by a company that we acquired.
Okay.
And that company was using the Freedom Move brand at the time without any authorization or nothing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. but the model behind was a good model. I mean, that was one of the first, you know, flexible mobility marketplace but on the market. And do you know what? Those guys, they were not taking any commission, nothing at all. I mean, they were just doing it, you know, for addressing a customer need, which was, I just want to have all the offer you know, reference at the same place at my fingertip. I just want, you know, to, okay, this morning, should I go for an Uber? Should I go for car sharing? But which car sharing, which company, that type of stuff? That was what the company, you know, proposed at the time. And we said, look, I mean, despite the fact that they are using our brand, make maybe sense, you know, to have something on our hand and try, you know, to see what can be built in terms of business model out of that. So we started then doing car sharing. We started covering cities. Then we said, okay, look, now we have that nice technology. We have a certain operation knowledge. We have, we know how to buy cars, doing insurance, how we can, you know, get customers, all of that. Why not trying to spread that thing over the Stellantis networks and even outside? So now we have as well a SaaS solution that is installed over 3,500 locations all over the world. So here are companies that are using the SaaS solution of Freedomove for offering mobility solutions to the customers on a daily basis. And we have 35,000 cars on that side of the business. So all of that together allows Freedomove to say, okay, look, you go to Berlin, you can use a Porsche. And you go outside Berlin, you can get a car from Freedomove or from one of the Freedomove partners for a week. Yeah. Traveling to DC, same thing, all of that. And if at the end you're not satisfied getting, you know, just pieces of car, you can do the micro lease solution from Freedomove to dealerships. That's how we do. Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's great. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure as well. Likewise. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And Nicole, Robbie, and I will all be back next week with a regular show talking about the stuff we're driving, including the Lexus LX700H. I also had a chance to drive an extended range EV motorhome last week. So stay tuned next week for that. And talk to you then. Bye.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.